Hi, my name's Armin. I'm an alcoholic.
Armin.
How's everybody feeling tonight? Should be feeling good. Because we have all been granted a reprieve from a hopeless and helpless state of mind, if you're here tonight. So it's funny. Years ago, in another life, I was the lead singer of a thrash metal band. I know that's part of it. But I can't get up on a stage in front of a microphone without saying, "Hello, 12-step house! Are you ready to rock?" Yeah, if you were looking for deep intellectual insights and stoicism tonight, you can probably leave now. So a couple of really important dates that I like to give right at the beginning of it. Oh, first of all, thank you, Ed, for asking me to do this. It's an honor to be the ninth person on your list that you have. I appreciate that. I have to tell you guys, this room and the 101 Club were the key rooms in my early sobriety. And I have a lot of nostalgia and good memories and a lot of great lessons learned in these halls. But I'd like to give a couple of dates right at the beginning. So the first date is June 11th, 1966. This was a glorious day in my family. It's the day that I was born. The second really important date, really the more important date, is November 3rd, 1993. That's the day I finally put down the drink and the drug. So this past November, I celebrated 30 years. That's amazing to me. I mean, it might not be that impressive to you. It's very impressive to the Coral Springs Police Department and the Broward Sheriff's Office. As soon as I disappeared from their radars, their jobs got a lot easier. In the big book, it talks about, and how it works, it talks about how we share in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. The general way of what I used to be like was, like I said, I was born June 11th, 1966 in a town called Watertown, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston. I'm Armenian, that's my ethnicity, and Watertown is one of the largest Armenian enclaves in the United States. In fact, until I was 5 years old, I didn't speak any English. I only spoke Armenian. I was surrounded by a really pungent and really impactful ethnic community. So yeah, I was used to a lot of love. I was used to a lot of hugs. I was used to being told that I was going to do great things. Men in my family routinely kissed each other on the cheek, sometimes on the lips, and big hugs. You know, I've always been a big hugger. It was funny, when I came into AA and I met all these kind of like hardcore Irish guys that didn't even want to hold hands at the end of the meeting, I would love to just go up to them and like just wrap them up with a bear hug, just make them as uncomfortable as I possibly could. So I came up with that ethnic foundation. When I was 7 years old, my dad moved us down to Florida. He got some business opportunities in what was then a fledgling town on the edge of the Everglades called Coral Springs. I grew up in Coral Springs. And back then, Coral Springs is a small town. When we moved here, there were 8,000 people in Coral Springs. And I played sports, and a lot of my coaches were police officers and firemen. My dad was a commissioner and a business owner in the town, and I had a very healthy sense of respect, of authority. It was just kind of this idyllic upbringing. I really don't remember having any major issues, you know. I always like to say if there's anything dysfunctional about my family, it was the fact that I was in it, right? Because I was the mess. And so for me, some of you might remember this. 1979, I go to see Kiss at the Hollywood Sportatorium. So music was an important part of my life, always has been, still is. Like, it's funny, Ed was following me to the meeting today, and he said, "Where were you going?" I was winding in and out of the neighborhoods and the roads, and I said, "I didn't know you were following me. There was a great tune on, and I didn't want to get to the 12-step house too early. I had to listen to the end, right?" You know. So 1979, I go to see Kiss. So the backstory of this is, for those, some of you younger people who know Kiss today, Kiss is kind of a schlocky caricature of themselves. But in the 70s and 80s, Kiss was a dangerous band. Like, parents did not want their kids to go see Kiss. And I was a member of the Kiss Army, me and my friend Stevie Pisano. We would just routinely go to school dressed up like members of KISS. Like, I would paint my face like Ace Frehley and go to school, you know? And he loved Gene, so he would do Gene Simmons. And we'd go to school together, and people would be like, look at these kids, right? And so KISS is coming to town, and I say to my mom, can I go to the KISS concert, Mom, please? And she said, there is no way, as long as you live under my roof, you will ever go see that band. And Christmas in 1978 comes, and I'm opening my gifts. I'm maybe 11, 12 years old. And my mom says, I think there's another gift in your stocking. Check your stocking. And I go to my stocking, and there were 3 tickets to the KISS concert.
Nice.
Now, if you guys remember back in those days, concert tickets came in like a little envelope, and you opened it up. And I was like, oh, my God, like, I have KISS tickets. And I said, Mom, you're the best. And she said, okay, you and Stevie can go. I already checked with Loretta, his mom. But you're going to have a chaperone. And one of my sister's friends was our chaperone. So my sister is about 5 or 6 years older than me. So the day of the show comes, my sister's friend shows up. She comes in to get us. We go out to the car. And the first thing she says when we get in the car, have you guys ever smoked pot before? And we were like, no, no. You know, our faces are painted. We're all excited to go see KISS. And she pulls out a joint and lights it up. And that was the beginning of an evening where I drank beer and Jack Daniels and smoked joints. And I walked into the Sportatorium. It was my first concert. And oh, my God. All, you remember, like, in the 80s and 70s, all the women used to wear their hair up to here. Like, so all the girls had, like, a whole can of Aquanet, and their hair was up to here. And they had on leather mini skirts, and the guys had concert T-shirts and long hair. And Gene was on stage, and he was spitting blood and breathing fire. And Ace's guitar was, oh, my God, I was in heaven, right? I leave that show, and all I wanted to do was rock and roll all night and party every day, you know? And came home, I asked my parents if I could get guitar lessons. They said yes. I started to play guitar, started going to bands, and all of a sudden everything changed. And this was one of those first kind of gates of my alcoholism, right? Because when you're in the music scene, it's fun to play music, but also drugs, girls, alcohol, parties, that's all part of the scene, right? And I took to that like you know, like flies to sugar. You know what I mean? I loved it. And went through high school, drank and drugged like everybody else I knew. You know, I really didn't know anybody that didn't drink and drug like me. And in fact, my friends and I used to have a joke, when you take the top off a bottle of liquor, you throw the top away, because what do you need the cap for? Like, it's not like we're saving that for later. Like, we're drinking everything, and then we're going to go looking for more. And that's the way we drank right out of the gate. I drank alcoholically pretty much out of the gate. And but like the big book talks about, there comes a time when alcohol turns on us. And for me, that was about 19 years of age. And what happened then was the state of Florida, the drinking age in 85 was 19. And they changed it on July 1st, 1985. And if your birthday was before July 1st, you got grandfathered in. And my birthday was June 11th. And my friend Carl Lombardo, his birthday was the 14th of April. So we were grandfathered in. So we were legal drinkers. Now, mind you, I'd already been going to bars for years and sneak. I always kind of looked older than I was, and we would sneak in. We didn't even need fake IDs in those days. It was Fort Lauderdale. Like, nobody checked anything, right? And we'd go to Artstock's Playpen, Heavy Metal Monday on Monday nights. I was going there for 3 years. I came in the day I turned 19. I showed the bartender my license. He goes, wait a minute. Like, I've been serving you for 3 years, you know? And I'm like, yeah, I'm official today, you know? And and so I started drinking in bars. And I should have known right then that my alcoholism was a little bit different, because all my friends were going to, you know, Confetti's, and, you know, what used to be called Pete and Lenny's, then it was Confetti's, and there was City Limits on Federal Highway, and they all these kind of fancy bars. And what I would do was I'd go to, like, the Lion's Den in Pompano, and I'd drink $2 highballs for, like, 2 hours before I went to meet my friends, right? Because I was an economic alcoholic, right? I had to get sufficiently wasted before I even showed up at the club. That's the way I drank. I was, later when I was a young adult, I would start drinking at home, and I would drink before I went out to drink, you know. Doing more, having more, wanting more was always a component of my alcoholism. You know, if you did 3 shots, I wanted to do 6 shots. If you did 1 hit of acid, I wanted to do 2 hits of acid. You know, I always felt like more was better for me. What was that all about? What that was all about was I was hiding. I was hiding. I didn't realize this till I came in the rooms and I did the work I did. All that facade that I put on when I was younger. You know, I was at a meeting last night, and a bunch of people were talking about how they were insecure and that's why they drank. I never felt that way. I always felt like I was like the life of the party. Like when I arrived, everybody was thrilled that I was there. You know, that's the way I saw the world, right? I learned later that what I was doing is I was hiding. I was putting up something that I wanted you to see, because I knew if you really saw who I was, you wouldn't like me, you know? Because I knew who I was and I didn't like me, you know? And I don't really know where that came from, but that was kind of like a real important part of my alcoholism. When I first walked into AA, I didn't understand a lot. I was learning, I was reading the steps, I was confused, there was the traditions. Then somebody put the concepts in front of me. I was like, ah, no, I don't want to look at that, right? Like, but the one thing I did understand was when you guys said we are egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. I totally understood that, right? If you saw me on the outside, you think I had it all together. I was the king of the hill. But on the inside, I felt so scared and afraid and nervous, you know, that you wouldn't like me. When I came into AA, it was funny because when we talk a lot in AA about need for approval, right? And I definitely had that. And to a certain degree, I still do have it. The funniest thing is when I walk in an AA meeting and I hear someone say, well, I don't care what anyone thinks about me. I know that person, that's all they're thinking about is what everybody thinks about them, right? Because I've been there trying to deny how much I needed your approval. Why? Because I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. I wasn't comfortable who I was. And how did I find the solution to that? I came into AA, and the men who picked me up early on in my recovery, they started to teach me about a higher power. You know, I remember when I did my first third step, my sponsor said, I want you to write down on a piece of paper what you want your God to be. Right? Because I also have to tell you, back it up, that I was raised in an Armenian Orthodox church, and I denied that at about 11 or 12 years old. So I came in with a lot of religious God baggage into AA, right? And my sponsor said, write down on a piece of paper what you want your God to be. And so I remember that I wrote this down. And even writing it down, I thought it sounded ridiculous. I was like, my God has to have long hair. He's got to have like an earring. He's got to have sleeve tats, you know. The first album in his Peaches crate has to be like Zeppelin 2, you know. And I go to like present it to my sponsor, and I thought he was going to laugh at me and say, this is ridiculous. And he went, no, that's cool. That's cool. He said, if that's your God right now, let that be your God. But just stay open-minded to the fact that you're going to grow spiritually, and you're going to change, and your God's going to change many times. Your concept of your higher power is going to change many times. And one of the things that I love, I'm not a big book quoter or any kind of literature quoter, but I do have a favorite reading in the 24-hour day book, and it just passed by. It was February 10th, and the reading reads as follows. It says, like a tree, I must be pruned of a lot of dead branches before I'll be ready to bear good fruit. Think of changed people as trees that have been stripped of their old branches, pruned, cut, and bare. But through the dark, seemingly dead branches flows silently, secretly, the new sap, until with the sun of spring comes new life. There are new leaves, buds, blossoms, and fruit, many times better because of the pruning. I'm in the hands of a master gardener who makes no mistake in his pruning. And the prayer for the day is, I pray that I may cut away the dead branches of my life. I pray that I may not mind the pruning, since it helps me to bear good fruit later. And that's basically has been my journey in AA, a continuous process of pruning, right? Like I said, I came here, I was 27 years old, I was a scared kid, I didn't know what was going on. I was angry, I was fearful, I didn't admit any of those things to you, you know. But the men who picked me up at the one-on-one club, there was a group of about 6 or 10 guys that just kind of surrounded me, and they walked me through this process. And you know, right at the head of the pack was my sponsor, who was my sponsor for 15 years, Mark O'Brien. And they taught me how to become a man, you know. I had a child when I was, she was actually born a year before I got sober. So when I got sober, she was 1 year old, Katie, my oldest daughter. And today, she's an attorney in Boston, which has nothing to do with my story. I just like to say that my daughter is an attorney in Boston. But, I paid for law school, right? I should at least get to do that. But anyway, you know, I came in and I had this child, and I was a child myself, you know. And you people in AA, you taught me how to be a parent. You taught me how to be a responsible employee. You taught me how to be a member of my community, right? I had gone through such a period of spiritual and moral decay that I was a complete reclamation job when I came in here. You know, I was one of those guys that needed a lot of work, you know. The other day I was with my friend Scott, and we were joking around, and I said something, you know. People who know me real well know that I kind of live by Rule 62. In fact, I'm thinking about getting a Rule 62 tat. You know, I really don't take anything seriously. I kind of just want to live life as a loose garment. And I said something, and Paul said, oh yeah, some are sicker than others, you know. And you have no idea. I was definitely some of the sicker than others, you know, no question. And I started to just follow these guys around and do what they did. And I remember there was a Saturday night meeting that we used to go to in Pompano. It was called Nine Chapter Group. It used to meet at St. Coleman's Church on Federal Highway. And after the meeting, these guys would take me out to dinner. And every time the bill came, if there were 7 of us, they would split it 6 ways. You know, they never let me pay the bill. And then I remember one night we were going out, and I said, yeah, I don't really know if I'm hungry. You know, my buddy Ed said to me, you're always hungry. He said, what's the problem? Why don't you want to go out? And I said, well, you know, Eddie, I'm taking you guys, you know, you guys are taking me out to dinner every night, and you're paying for my dinner, and I don't feel like I'm contributing my part. He said, listen to me. We're taking you out because we want you to be a part of the fellowship with us. There's going to come a day when you're sober, and there's going to be a new guy that wants to go out, but he's kind of standing off to the side, and he doesn't know how to bring himself into the middle. And you put your arm around that guy, and you say, come on, you're coming with us. And you just pick up his tab. You don't even question it, right? Because that's what we do for each other. That's the way I paid back what they did for me. I paid it forward, right? And that's what we do in AA. It's incredible, the love, the genuine love that I've experienced here. I was sitting outside before the meeting in the cigar circle, and I was looking around, and, you know, in that circle, you know, a handful of men that have been instrumental in my sobriety, you know, and I was just thinking to myself how grateful I am to have had that, right, to be able to come in, because a lot of people come in and they don't get this thing, right, and I get that, because it took me 3 years to get it, almost 4 years to get it, and I'll talk about that a little more in the second hour of my talk, but, no, really, we should get to the part where how I got here, right? So 1989, 1990, I'm running like a crazy man, you know. I'm crossing moral and ethical lines. The deterioration of my spiritual condition, which I didn't even know it existed, was at an all-time low, you know. And it was Christmas of 1990, and I got a Christmas bonus from my boss, and he gave us our Christmas bonuses in these bank envelopes. And my Christmas bonus was $500. And I called my wife, and she said, how much was your bonus? And I made a tactical alcoholic error. I gave her the actual amount. So me and a bunch of guys from work, we went out and we started drinking pitchers, and, you know, and then everybody kind of broke off and said, hey, Merry Christmas, see you in a couple of days, and blah, blah, blah. And I went down to Hammondville, and I went on a 3-day run. And I came back to my apartment, and I opened the front door on Sunday afternoon, and there sat my wife, my mother, my sister, my brother-in-law, my 2-year-old niece and my neighbor from across the street, Ellen, who was a treatment professional at a place called National Recovery Institute. And I didn't know, you know, the show on A&E, Intervention, hadn't come out yet, so I didn't really know, like, what was happening here. But I knew, like, this wasn't good. This wasn't looking good for me, you know. And they started to go one by one and tell me how my drinking and drugging was affecting their lives. And that was a really important moment for me, because when I was out there drinking, I spent a lot of time saying, hey, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, you know. Just leave me alone. Let me do my thing. Why are you bothering me? You know? But I was bothering people. I was hurting people. I was impacting other people. There were people that were praying for me and hoping that I would find a way out of this mess, that I would find a solution. I don't remember what anybody in that room said that night, except for my niece, who was 2 years old, and she said, Uncle, I just don't want you to die. And that's the only thing I remember from that day. And my sister gave me a phone number, and I called the phone number, and it was actually the Narcotics Anonymous hotline. And they said, someone will call you back in 20 minutes, and this guy called me back. And for the first time, somebody understood what I was going through, you know. And he was telling me some of his story, and I was telling him some of my story. And he said, meet me at this clubhouse over in, by Searstown in Fort Lauderdale. There used to be an NA clubhouse there. And I went there, and I met him. I don't even really remember, like, that meeting or anything. You know, I remember coming out, and there was this big blue rack that had all these pamphlets in it. And I remember sitting in the meeting and looking at the steps on the wall, and I did them all in the meeting. And then after the meeting, I went and took, like, one of every pamphlet. Like, you know, it didn't even matter. Are you pregnant? And I'm like, yeah, I'm taking that. And so I get back to my apartment, and now everybody was gone except just my mother and my wife and my sister. And my sister said, so what happened? How was the meeting? And I said, it was great. They got these step things. I did them. And I have this stack of pamphlets that I'm going to read every day. And I think we're good, you know. And that was Christmas in 1990, and like I said, I didn't get sober till November 3rd, 93. In between those two dates, I went through three rehabs, one high-priced $40,000 rehab that was, you know, a 30-day rehab that I stayed for 7 days. And, you know, I remember the first time I got high after leaving that rehab, I called it my $40,000 and 20 rock, right? Because I paid for that rehab, and then I just went relapse right after, you know? And I ended up going to two more rehabs. I ended up going through BARC twice, down on 11th and Broward. And I remember the second time I went through BARC, I was such a mess that they were just giving me fluids for 3 days. I couldn't even get up and go to the meetings. I was just laying in bed because I was beating up my body. I was beating up my spirit. I was beating up my soul, you know. And during that time, I also did a 6-month stint in the Broward County Jail. You know, and I remember when I was in the Broward County Jail, a guy came in and he said, when you get out of here, let the first day out be like how you want all the rest of your days to be. And I remember I got sprung in October at like 1:30 in the morning. They give you a garbage bag full of stuff and put you on Powerline Road at 1:30 in the morning. And I walked from Powerline Road down McNabb, Dixie Highway, all the way to 101 Club. I got to the 101 at like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I slept on the picnic bench outside. And this woman came in, and she was setting up for the meeting. And she said, why don't you come in and help me make some coffee? And I went in. I didn't know this woman, you know. And then a bunch of people came in, and she said, why don't you go sit over by that guy over there at that table? It was the first table by the plexiglass at the 101 Club. And that guy's name was Ray Allen. And I sat down next to him, and I learned later that he was actually my great-grand sponsor, but I didn't know that. And I told him my name, and he said, you know, he was saying, you're going to be all right, kid. It was like he had really bad arthritis. He used to wear these mittens, and he said, you're going to be all right. Just keep doing what you're doing. Keep coming here. I left that meeting. I went to the Lamb of God next door. I asked them if they had a bed, and the pastor said, no, we don't have a bed. And I said, well, can I put my bag down in this room, and I'm going to just kind of go looking for a job, and so on and so forth. He goes, yeah, go in the chapel and put it in there. I went in there, put my bag down. I got on my knees, and I said, God, I need this. Like, I need to be sober. I can't keep doing this. I did not want to go back to jail again. I did not want to live that life anymore. And I got up and I left, walked up Dixie Highway, and I got a job at this place called McNeil Signs. And they brought me on as a helper, and they said, be here at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, and you got a job. And walked back to the Lamb of God, came in, and the pastor's name was Jim. He was one of the associate pastors there. He said, hey, I got a bed for you. Bed opened up. And I had, so within about 4 hours of the sun rising, I got in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I met Ray Allen. I had a place to live, and I had a job, you know. And looking back on it now, it was a miracle, right? And years later, Jim and I became friends. He ended up moving to Tennessee, but one day we were talking, and he said, I said, remember that time when I came in? And he said, of course I remember when you first got here. He said, I had a bed the first time you came in, but you just looked like a really shady character, and I wasn't sure why. He said, and when you went into the chapel to put your bag down, you were in there a little bit too long, so I peeked in and I saw you praying. And I said, if this kid comes back, I'm going to give him a bed. And I made my way, and I came back, and I got a bed, and that began my journey, you know. And I didn't stay sober right from that moment. That was October 1991. I still did a little more relapsing. But, you know, we have those moments where, like, the flower blossoms and things happen for us that are almost metaphysical, right? And we don't see them in the moment, right? I don't see those things until I look back on them and I go, wow, what a morning that was for me. Like, if that morning, if my higher power doesn't construct and arrange that morning the way it happened, I'd probably be dead or in prison right now, you know? And so I begin the journey in recovery. And I start going to meetings at the 10 and a 12-step house. And this group of men would just tell me, we're picking you up at 5:30, we're going to dinner, then we're going to the meeting. They didn't give me a choice. They didn't tell me, meet us. I had a car, right? They were like, don't meet us at the meeting. We'll come and get you. They wanted to make sure I was getting in that car. And the beautiful thing that happened is in that car, I got the meeting before the meeting, right? And then on the ride home, I got the meeting after the meeting. We don't do them down here, but up in Massachusetts, we do something called commitments, where one group will go speak at another group, and then that group will come back and speak at that group. So when you go on a commitment, you meet 10, 15 people, you break up into three cars, and you go to a meeting. And then that group returns a favor. Those car rides are the best meetings, right? I mean, the meetings themselves are great. Sometimes they're not. Who really cares? It's the car rides. It's getting to know the people. I had an early mentor in AA. His name was Ed McNamara. He passed away. He taught me so much. He definitely taught me as much as any of my sponsors taught me. But one of the things he taught me was, you get information in meetings, but you get recoveries in diners and parking lots, right? So that's why you will usually find me at a meeting an hour or so before the meeting. And then I'm usually hanging out after the meeting, half hour, hour, because that's where it happens, right? I come in here and I hear some good stuff and I go, oh, that's very nice. That's very intellectual. I can chew on that a little bit. But when I'm out in the parking lot and maybe we're just kicking it, we're talking about nothing. But then one guy will say, hey, I'm going through something. And then everybody turns their attention to that guy, and we start to share our experience, strength, and hope. You know, as I progressed in sobriety, my spiritual condition grew. It changed several times, you know, just like my sponsor said it was gonna. And early on in sobriety, I was doing remodel jobs. I was working for a glass company, and we were doing, so I don't know if you guys remember, but like in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, there was a whole regentrification of like Victoria Park and the area around 15th Street, and people were buying up those old kind of dilapidated houses, and they were turning them into, you know, remodeling them and turning them into something that was saleable and really bringing up the neighborhood. And the guy I was working for got a lot of those contracts. And I remember one day I'm sitting in one of these houses, and It's a mess. And I started to think to myself, you know, this house is a mess. Just like when I came into AA, my spiritual house was a mess, right? My spiritual house was a place where my soul lived, and it was unlivable. Right? And that's why I was so conflicted, and that's why I was so fearful, and that's why I was so confused. And I didn't have a God in my life. So I had nowhere to turn for relief, right? And I didn't know you guys yet. So I had nowhere to go for relief. And I was living in this dilapidated spiritual house. And then I came to step two, and you guys told me, hey, we know a guy that can help you fix your place up, right? And you introduced me to my higher power. And then in step three, I made a decision to hire that person. You know, if you want to think of him as maybe a spiritual contractor, right? So I hired God as my spiritual contractor to come and fix up my house. And in step four, you know, in the big book, it says we get a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition, right? A lot of people leave the word maintenance out sometimes when they quote that line. To me, that's the most important. That's the most important word in that, right? Because when I think about a maintenance man, somebody takes care of a building, let's say. Some of you folks have probably been maintenance people, right? If you don't take care of that building for a week, it goes into a certain level of disarray. Right? If you don't take care of it for a month, it gets a little worse. If you don't take care of it for 6 months, it becomes dilapidated, right? I didn't take care of my spiritual house for 27 years. So it was completely non-functional. And I came in here and I hired the contractor in step three. And I remember one time I was doing my third step and I was struggling a little bit with it. And there's a guy named Alabama Bill. He used to go to the 101 club. And I said to Bill, I'm struggling with my third step. And he said, what's the problem? I said, I can't do this turning over thing. It goes against like everything I learned on the street, right? Like on the street, you never turn over anything. You fight to the end, right? I'm fighting you till one of us can't fight anymore, right? And he said, well, I think you're missing a really important word in that step, which is care. He said, we're not really asking you to give your life over to God. What we're asking you to do is bring him in to be your caretaker. He said, let's say you go to your mailbox tomorrow morning and you got a rich uncle somewhere and he left you a 1,000-acre plantation. He said, do you know anything about cultivating crops, taking care of livestock? I said, no, I don't know anything about that. He said, well, then it might make sense that you hire a caretaker that knows how to take care of that plantation, right? And leverage, maximum leverage the benefits of that farm. And I said, yeah, that does make sense. That's what we're doing here. We're asking God to come in and be our partner and help us to manage this new 1,000-acre life that AA just gave us that we have no idea how to manage, right? And step four, it's time to do a walkthrough. Right, the place is a mess. I got to go through. Yeah, some wiring needs to be changed. You know, plumbing's got to go out. I got to redo these windows. In step five, I sit down with God, the contractor, myself, and my sponsor, who's like one of the subs, maybe, right? And we go through the walkthrough, and we talk about what needs to be fixed. And then in six and seven, I bring God in to do his work, right? Yeah, I used to have a friend of mine who used to come to this clubhouse many, many years ago, Pete Cherry. And Pete always used to say, I don't see Pete anywhere in six and seven, right? Because that's not about me. A lot of people say, you know, I remember when I was going through my seventh step and I would say to my sponsor, well, I'm working on my anger today. And he would say, well, how is that going? And I'd say, I've been pissed off all day long. Right? Because it's not up to me to remove my defect. If we remember what it says in the seventh step prayer, right, it says we ask God to remove those things that stand in the way of our usefulness to him and our fellows. So it's not the things I want removed. It's the thing my higher power wants removed that make me useful. Then I get to step eight and nine, and I start to, you know, go out and knock on the neighbor's doors and say, listen, I know I've let the place go a little bit over the years, but you see God's trucks in the driveway. We're fixing it up, you know. It's going to be in good shape pretty soon. And it's starting to get in good shape. And so now every day I do a smaller walkthrough so I don't have to do that massive remodeling job. I just go through every day in the 10th step and I say, oh, light bulb's out. I'm going to change it, right? Fan's not working right. I'm going to, you know, tweak that a little bit. And I can do the 10th step allows me, you know, my friend Joel calls the 10th step the permission to be human step. And I love that, right? Because he says, We go to step 1 through 9, and ostensibly at that point, we should be pretty good. Like, we should be pretty clean. But our founders knew that we would screw up, right? So they didn't say, maybe step 10. No, when you get to step 10 and when you screw up, this is what we do to fix things, right? This is what we do to fix things quickly so we don't get into those deep jackpots and those holes. So now it comes to step 11, and I'm seeking through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with the contractor, right? I'm getting to know him better. And why do I want to do that? So that when I get to step 12 and I walk into a meeting and I see that person in the room, and I look at their eyes and I know they're hurting, right? I can see it because I've been there. You know, we've all seen them. Can't hold the coffee cup, it's shaking, it's spilling all over their hands, right? You know, back in the old days, I had a friend of mine in the one-on-one club. He used to bring a bag of Hershey's Kisses and 2 packs of Marlboro Reds to every meeting. And I never saw him eat a Hershey's Kiss, and I never saw him smoke a Marlboro Red. And I asked him one day, I said, Jack, why do you bring these to every meeting and you never touch them? He said, because one day there's going to be a newcomer that needs a cigarette and a Hershey's Kiss to make it through an hour meeting, and I'm going to be right there waiting with what he needs, right? That's 12-step work, man. That's grassroots 12-step work, you know? And so I go to step 11, and I build this relationship so that when it comes to step 12 and I see that guy with his hand shaking and he's hurting, and I can see it, and I go up to him at the end and I say, I know a guy. Right? And we start the whole process over again. And the beautiful thing about sponsoring is I get to go through that process over and over again with my sponsees. And I get to relive it for myself. I get to reshare everything you guys have taught me and pass it on to that next person, you know? So they talk about this in the big book at the very end of 164. And I know those of you who studied this book, you know this line well, right? Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Abandon yourself, right? Don't just say, check on God. Hey, God, I'll see you on Tuesdays and Thursdays, right? No, I'm abandoning myself to a higher power. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. I had one of my sponsees tell me a couple months ago, he said, dude, you wear everything on your sleeve. I said, absolutely, because I have to admit all my faults. The things that I hide are the things that will destroy me, right? So I'm gonna stand outside with you guys and I'm gonna tell you everything I'm doing and everything I'm going through. And then you get to know me well enough and then you can call me out on my stuff. You know, I was out with a few friends about a month ago and three of them told me very sternly about how they weren't happy with some of my behavior, you know? And initially I said, I'm 30 years sober, don't be telling me about my behavior, man. I know what I'm doing, you know? But then as my pattern has become, a week or two went by and I started thinking, you know what? They were spot on. Because these guys know me better than anybody. All these guys have known me for 25 years, you know, or more. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past, right? Go through this step work. Clean it up a little bit. Nobody's asking you to do it overnight. It took me 7 years to go through the steps my first time. I'm not recommending that for anybody, but that's what it took me, right? We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Now remember, when this book was written, there was no social media, there were no cell phones, there weren't 300 meetings a week in every major town in the United States. These things were few and far between, and they were hoping that we would meet each other on the road to happy destiny, and they did. If you think about how AA spread in the early days, it's actually incredible. It was completely a word of mouth spread, right? One guy would hear about it, go back to his hometown, start a meeting. Another guy would be traveling salesman, go to another town, start a meeting. That's how it spread. The road of happy destiny. And then this line is so hokey that I remember the first time I read it, I was like, oh, here we go, you know, religion stuff. But now when I read this line, it almost makes me want to cry. Right? May God bless you and keep you until then. Right? So now we're lucky. We can come to the 12th apostle on a Saturday night with 100 people We don't have to go trudge the road to happy destiny. We can just come down 12 step aisles in Fort Lauderdale and we can meet 100 people that are trying to do the same thing we're trying to do. And we can pass it on and we can help each other. And man, I am a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. I seriously am. Thank you for listening.